Well, you may listen to this podcast from afar. You might be living in London, you might be in Japan, you might be in Canada, you might be in the US and A, you might be in Asia, wherever you are. Thanks for listening. Thanks for checking in back home and getting encouraged and all that with your money. Or you could be looking at departing Australia and moving for some time overseas or relocating. And then I think there could be a third type where you're looking to repatriate back to Australia. Maybe you've had some time overseas and you've called, I don't know, the UK home for 10 years like many Aussies do, and then you come back and call Australia home again. There's a lot of complexities when we are talking about money, international laws, international borders, and we're going to talk about all that today. Today's episode is brought to you by Sphere Home Loans. We are so pro mortgage broker because we have seen the results when you use a mortgage broker who are dialed in, who are onto what's happening in the mortgage world, whether it is ordering different valuations and looking at a strategy based on the bank that has a better valuation than bank B and it's got a 0.1% higher interest rate. So then, well, this is more appropriate because that's more important than a 0.1% interest rate more, different financial products, all the things that are needed to consider when it comes to your mortgage. You can reach out to Sphere Home Loans via Google or click the link in the show notes. My name's Glenn James. I'm joined by James Ridley from Atlas Wealth. He's our resident expat money financial advisor guy. He's been on the show once or twice before, and we welcome him back today. My name's Glenn James, and this is Money.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
James, welcome back to the podcast.
G'day, Glenn. Thanks for having me back on.
Thanks for looking out for a heap of listeners for us. We often refer listeners to you who have curly financial planning needs and they're departing or returning or living abroad. Now, just tell us a little bit about what you do at Atlas Wealth.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, Atlas Wealth Management, or I guess Atlas Wealth Group, we mainly focus on Australians or Aussies that are first heading overseas, becoming an expat, or they're already overseas, or they're about to come home and they've got some tricky, I guess, financial situations because their assets are spread not just in Australia, but maybe across one, two, three, four countries. I've seen them all. We help guide them through, I guess, a bit of process of continuing to build wealth, but ultimately trying to set themselves up for the long term. You know, this can factor into long-term retirement planning or overall just building wealth in the right manner. So that way they're not getting in trouble with the ATO. And a lot of that will always come down to sort of tax residency, which I'll probably talk about a little bit later today. But generally that's who we help. A lot of my clients that have repatriated, they might come back and just be working again back in Australia, or they're retired in Australia, but they've done the right things whilst they've been away to continue to build their wealth back in Australia. So they've set themselves up correctly. But that being said, a lot of our clients, they won't come back to Australia ever. So they still want to make sure they've got some sort of, I guess, asset base here to support them, depending where they're going to retire somewhere overseas.
Now, you've got an office in Queensland. Internationally, do you have presence around the globe?
We do. We have another office actually based over in Dubai. So that's where my business partner, Brett Evans, is based. And then we got licensed over there as well. We're set up there locally. And we've been there for a couple of years now. And as we continue to grow, we definitely want to have more offices around the world to help Australians. You know, as we know, there's big networks of Australians in the UK, especially London. You look at the US, that's just a huge population demographic there. And in the areas that you'd typically imagine, you know, New York, LA, all those sort of places, California. So that's sort of the goal as we continue to grow.
Why the UAE? Was it easy for Brett? Because he's got his family there, right? Was it a time zone thing and more of he's a real hub of an area?
Yeah, I think initially it was more of a time zone area because we could essentially trying to just cut the world in half. And it's a lot easier to for him to be looking after the Europe, the Middle East, and obviously the Africa's region, because it's on a very similar time zone compared to, say, me that's trying to have a call with someone that's in London where, you know, it's maybe 4:30 p.m. my time, but it's still 7:30 a.m. their time. So I still have clients in that region, but setting up obviously times is just a little bit more finicky. Yeah. So that was the natural need there. And I mean, it's sort of the gateway as well. We found the UAE or Dubai. It's, you know, it's the probably the busiest airport that exists. Maybe not lately because of all the flooding.
Yeah.
But that being said, that's where the need come from, just to cut the world in half so we can manage the time zones. And then we wanted to get licensed over there just to use that as sort of the initial footprint to keep building.
Going west
to other countries. That's right. Yeah.
All right. Now we're just answering questions today from the Facebook group. I'm just going to jump in, no particular order. Anonymous said, "I'm a dual citizen planning to relocate to the UK for a few years. Should I be topping up my super and hex while I'm away? And if so, can you provide a rough guide to help me calculate suitable payments?"
Really good question. I mean, hex. I want to talk about HEX. HEX has obviously gained a lot of, traction the last 12 months because of that indexation factor last year. It was huge. And I know you've talked about it as well in your podcasts. And HEX and doing a worldwide income lodgement is something you always have to do as an expat. So, I mean, whether you're paying it down more aggressively or not, either way, if your income's over that certain threshold, generally 45,000, you're going to have to make some sort of repayment on it. So it really just depends. But HEX is one of those things you can't really escape. They changed the rules back in 2017. So all Australians overseas working full time will have to do a worldwide income lodgement. And I guess we can almost treat this as a bit of a stealth tax back in Australia. And it's not something that really gets talked about much, but it's definitely a stealth tax. I know a lot of clients that I have over in the Middle East, you know, on tax-free incomes, that's great. But then they're on a big income 1 year and then they realize they've got to make a $10,000 or a $15,000 repayment on their HEX. And they're like, oh, wow, where did that come from? So it is a stealth tax until you wind it down, that's for sure. And then superannuation, it really just depends. Super is one of those things where if you don't have someone putting away at least 11% of your income into a retirement asset, you should be doing something equivalent. That's where I would go with that thought line.
Yeah. So while you're overseas, the contributions to super, they've got to be a non-concessional contribution, so a post-tax, is that correct?
That is correct. The only other time you'd use a pre-tax contribution, a concessional, would be maybe you were trying to offset some sort of other income in Australia, like rental property income.
Right.
And I guess the reason for that is rental property income in Australia, if your income is more than all your tax deductions, you're going to pay 32.5% tax on that because you're a non-resident for tax purposes.
Yeah. So I think, you know, a rough guide to help calculate suitable payments, I've just got the ATO repayment calculator up for, you know, help debt and hex debt. Like round numbers, if you were earning 100K AU overseas, you've probably got to keep in the back of your mind that 6% or $6,000 will need to come home to roost in Australia. That's what I'll use as a rough guide, quote unquote. Now, the super thing, it's interesting as well because this is where it's not a mandatory thing. It's a nice to have retirement savings. So I'm thinking, you know, the current rate's being 11%. If you're living overseas and you know you're coming back to Australia, because I think that's the one of the big things, isn't it? Like you categorically know that I'm over there for 3 or 4 years and I am coming back. Now, I think the super thing gets pretty practical where you might be living in London and you're not earning a lot. And it's just like, I don't, you know, if you look at 100 grand income, let's call it 10 grand a year Australian, I don't have a spare 10 grand a year to put into my super. Probably not doing it because I'm trying to pay rent here and live here. Now, that's really horrendous financial advice, but the reality is you might not have any money to do that. But if you do have money, as a rough guide, I think that 10% is probably a good guide.
Choose
5%.
Just do something.
Actually, this is interesting as well, James. As a financial advisor, what if you just... And this kind of comes back to how strategic somebody is. We're just saving cash overseas, then when we get back, we use the the catch up contributions. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Help so, when you start earning money in Australia again. So I'd maybe consider that, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good strategy because, I mean, catch
offset up. Some tax,
you know,
on the way back.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly right. And that's a really important repatriation strategy when Aussies are first coming back. If they haven't used any of their concessional, their pre-tax contributions, they can use the catch up. And in that year where there's a year of transition, where if they're a lot older and if they're taking out maybe a pension or a 401k as a lump sum, the confusion is that that's not going to be taxable, but a lot of the time they are taxable in Australia, and that's a nasty surprise for those returning expats or repats. And then using a catch-up concessional contribution can certainly wipe out a lot of the taxable income. Yes, it is going to be taxed at 15% within super, but gosh, it's much better than being taxed all the way up to your marginal tax rate of 47% with the Medicare levy.
Mm. So, yeah, I think the more I chew on that one is, number one, I would be maybe just doing each saving money overseas and maybe every June reviewing my circumstances.
Mm.
And like, yeah, we could put some in, or look, we're going to keep saving just to have a really stronger emergency fund while we're away. Yep. And then maybe when we get back, we're like, okay, we've got all this money. But then it's so annoying. Financial planning walks in the door. Or do you want to buy a house now? And it's like, what do you want to do? This is wild.
And there are alternatives. I mean, if I look at a lot of my clients that are quite young, their priority isn't putting money into super whilst they're overseas. Let's be honest. They'd rather build up some savings.
Travel,
maybe
if you
consider,
will.
that's right. And that's exactly what they do, especially when they're in the UK. They just jump on the train. They're in another country in an hour. But another alternative might be they invest it in, say, some sort of investment account, because they can access the funds immediately if they need to for maybe an emergency. But maybe they're primary focus is going to be buying a property in the next couple of years so they can access those funds rather than it being locked away in super.
And this is how complex and crazy this world is. Like, we're not through the first question yet and we've got all these scenarios. If someone was working in the UK for a few years like a non, are we setting an investment account up in Australia or in the UK?
Well, if they're only going to be in the UK for a couple of years, you're better off setting up in Australia, I would imagine.
But does the tax residency, is that kind of after the fact, like you do it more for the cost base and so you don't have to sell when you move or anything like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, let's jump in that tax residency, what you just said there, that comment, because, I mean, generally speaking, if you're only going to be overseas for, say, 1 to 3 years.
It's a holiday.
It is. It's going to be really hard for that Australian to deem themselves to be a non-resident of Australia. And we've seen a lot of, I would say, private rulings come out recently from the ATO where they're really drilling down on particular details. There was one recently for an Aussie that was in Dubai, and they drilled down on the fact that he maintained an Australian license, a driver's license, I should say. So they really nitpicked at his situation. And I'll be honest, I've got clients where if the ATO nitpick them, well, they're going to have a difficult time maybe managing their own tax residency or non-residency, I should say. I'm happy to admit it, because it's just such a grey area. Now, if you are going to be a non-resident and going to be based overseas for, say, more than 3 years, you know, let's say 5 years, then still investing back in Australia in an investment account is still going to be pretty attractive, because you can reset the cost base by doing something which is called deemed disposal. And deemed disposal is paying tax on that account up until you leave Australia. And then you've reset the cost base for the growth of that account to be tax-free now until you come back to Australia. So that's really attractive for anyone that's sort of, I would say, doing a dollar cost averaging contribution plan to that, sending a bit of their savings back each month and building it. And that way they're building an asset back in Australia in their home currency. And at least when they come home, they've actually got something to show for it, rather than spending all the money that's coming in. And, you know, having holidays is great, but you don't want to be overseas for 5 years and not have maybe a little bit of an asset base behind you and have built something for yourself.
At what point would you recommend someone, how can I say this? Like, if someone goes to, they're like, I want to go to the UK for 12 months and get a job and work and all that over there, they remain a resident of Australia, a tax resident of Australia?
Yeah, one of my mates just asked me this recently. They've like landed, I guess, a paid internship opportunity at an asset manager. So I'm going over for 12 months. You know, what do I do about my tax? And I was like, no, it's too short a time frame to really do anything, to be honest. I think based on 12-month time frame, you're still going to be an Australian tax resident. There's a double taxation agreement in place. Their marginal tax rates over in the UK are really similar. So you'll get a tax credit there back in Australia. The only thing that you'll probably get a little nasty surprise on will be you'll have a bit of a HECS payment due as well. So prepare for that.
So is there a line in the sand? Is it like we think we're going to be more than 12 months overseas, or it is going to turn into a permanent or a semi-permanent thing with no current plans to return home? Like, at what point do you start looking to move your tax residency?
I would say 12 plus months is definitely going to be that sort of, I guess, that circuit breaker where you're like, okay, this is when we are going to become a non-resident. When you look at our tax residency rules right now, you know, they are a bit grey, and that's something which is like a really important update. I'll talk about it soon because I'm sure there is going to be a question there about tax residency and the proposed changes that are coming. But when you think about when the decision comes about to actually treat yourself as a non-resident, 12 months. I think 12 months after you've been overseas, you're starting to set everything up like you're a non-resident. You're cancelling your private health insurance policy back in Australia if you have one. You're letting the banks know that you've moved overseas permanently. So now they're withholding tax on the interest income. All those sort of things come into that.
And is there a point where you need to tell the Australian government that you're no longer, or the ATO, or do you kind of make that decision formally on paper when you do your first tax return once you've left Australia?
Yeah, you're spot on. So when we deem ourselves or declare ourselves to be non-residents, it is done, I guess, retrospectively. It's done in hindsight once we've been overseas for a little while. And it's just done through the tax system. You know, we lodge our tax return, we nominate ourselves as being a non-resident. If you've got a complex financial situation, and, you know, what I mean by that is maybe you've got an investment property or some share investments, those sort of things, it's best to get some actual advice around what's going to happen to those assets. But you're deeming yourself to be a non-resident going forward, and that will have a tax impact on the assets that you hold back in Australia. So you obviously need to arm yourself with a bit more information of what that means. But yes, through the tax system, you can also log in on your MyGov, update your ATO, that you're non-resident. You can update them with your overseas address. The same with Medicare as well. You can technically still use Medicare for up to 5 years once you've left Australia. After that, we wouldn't recommend that you renew it, because that's actually things that have been caught in some of the case rulings, tax rulings by the ATO.
Mm. Yeah, so they're looking for that nexus between you wanting your cake and eating it too, basically.
Absolutely, spot on. And whether you've actually really cut ties with Australia permanently, are you doing things that, you know, someone that has left Australia permanently would ordinarily do, or are you coming back every couple of months, checking in with the family, you're keeping your old home vacant so you can just move into it quickly for a couple of weeks and move back over, all those sort of things, those habits, they all add up to your residency.
Can you talk to us about the residency updates and the proposals that are happening at the moment?
Yeah, sure. So this update was announced, over a year ago through the budget. And what they wanted to do is update our tax residency rules. And right now, just to give all our listeners a bit of an insight, our current tax residency rules, they're based off the 1936 Tax Act. So we're no longer getting around in ship. We're no longer getting around in ships anymore or anything like that. But that's why they need to be updated. So need to obviously move towards, you know, a modern workforce that, you know, is obviously very mobile, moving around. So instead of, the old rules, they're trying to bring it forward where the main concern right now is the four-factor tests, which is a big concern. And I'm going to drill down on one specific one. And it's based on this 45-day factor test, where if you are in Australia and you're an Australian citizen or a permanent resident, and you're in Australia for more than 45 days accidentally in an Australian financial year, you can accidentally become a tax resident again. So that's the big concern there. There is going to be what's called a tiebreaker test. And a tiebreaker test is included in a lot of our double taxation agreements, where it's essentially saying you can only be a tax resident of one country. So as an example, if you're a non-resident of Australia, but let's say you're a tax resident of the United States, and based on the residency rules laid out in the, the Tax Act over in the US, if you're only in Australia for, say, 60 days, but you're still being treated as a US tax resident, then you can still be a non-resident of Australia. But that's just part of the proposal. This hasn't been legislated. We still haven't seen a draft legislation piece, and that's what's got everyone very concerned, because they announced it, they opened it up for consultation last year around September. We all submitted our papers, our white papers, and then we haven't heard too much from the government again. So we do think we will hear something next month about this in terms of the pathway forward of when they're going to legislate it. The biggest concern right now is all those expats, Aussies, that are actually based in countries without a double taxation agreement, they're going to be in a lot of trouble if they don't update them. And this is countries like the Middle East, you know, a lot of European countries, a lot of Southeast Asian countries. They will have to abide by that 45-day rule. And that's the biggest concern. And to show you how, or to talk about how punitive it is, if you arrived in Australia for, say, in August, as an example, and you were here for a couple of weeks, you flew back and then you came back again in, say, May, and then you accidentally in May blew through that 45-day total rule, your tax residency would have actually started back in August with Australia, not sort of that second period. So that's the biggest concern at the moment, them updating these tax residency rules, but not providing a bit more flexibility around that 45-day factor test. We need to increase it to at least 90 days to be on par with Singapore, a little bit on par with the UK, and a little bit on par with, I would say, some of the Southeast Asian countries as well.
You're in the weeds of all this and keeping the finger on the legislative pulse. Are you confident there will be a reasonable and, you know, good outcome?
I'm confident they will amend it to not be 45 days. I'm confident that they'll increase that. I don't know what they'll increase it to, because there was a lot of proposals that wanted to just up it to 60 days. We proposed 90 days, plus a bit of a formula to work out whether that expat's becoming an Australian tax resident again. We're reasonably confident that we will see these new rules legislated in the next 18 months. We think they'll apply as of 1 July 2025, which means we're going to see a lot in the next sort of 6 to 12 months from the government.
For someone that's out there in the wild listening to this, it might be the first time they've heard of a potential change if they've got to visit Australia a couple of times within a financial year or whatnot. Can they follow like Atlas Wealth on like Instagram, or have you got an email list, or can they go to your website? Like, do you guys provide regular info? Or your podcast?
Yeah, we do. So we have an emailing list. We have Facebook. Give us a follow on the Facebook page, LinkedIn as well. We will put out a lot through there. I mean, the budget's up next month, so we'll be doing a webinar on that as well. But we run our own podcast. I'll admit our expat chat has taken a bit of a backseat lately, just because Brett's been hindered by everything going on in Dubai with all the flooding. So we've had to push pause, unfortunately, for our listeners. But outside of that, we do have an emailing list. We do have LinkedIn. We do have Facebook, and that's where we put out a lot of these important updates.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I'm glad that we've done a bit of an update and answered one question, and it's been 20 minutes. All right. Only about a million to go. Tony, as a Kiwi now eligible to be a dual citizen in Australia after the rule change, are there any financial implications that need to be considered before doing this? So just for my own benefit, the rule change was pretty much like, hey, Kiwis, come in, all good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sweet. Yeah. They're pretty much just saying, yep, all right, a lot easier for them to have a pathway to Australian citizenship now. Yeah. Yeah. Rather than having to wait sort of 10 plus years, I think initially it was. It's sort of like if you've been here for a much shorter period, it's like, yep, that's okay. Here you go.
Sweet. So any implications that Tony needs to consider?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I'd have more questions for Tony. What I would say is depends on your asset base. It really does. We, you know, without knowing what assets you have, say, back in New Zealand, I don't know how it's going to have an impact on you. So if you're already living in Australia, if you're already an Australian tax resident, then you're going to be sort of in our system. So there wouldn't be too many changes. It depends on whether you're going to be looking at trying to access, say, the age pension. That's one very unique differentiator between New Zealand and Australia. in New Zealand, they have something just called New Zealand Super, which is actually their standardized pension, which everyone can actually qualify for when they live there for usually a minimum of 10 years, but that's increasing. It's not asset tested. It's not income tested. And if you're single or a couple, it can range between $20,000 to $40,000 per year. However, if you are a dual citizen, maybe that might have an impact on you being able to access it, because if you're in Australia, you won't be able to access the New Zealand Super because they'll apply the Australian age pension test to you. And if you've got assets, like most people do, then you're not going to qualify for it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So that could be a bit of a drawback of that if you're retired in Australia. If you're retired in New Zealand, then not so much.
Mm. Well, there you go, Tony. That's don't pull that thread. Mackenzie, is there any way of transferring a UK pension over into the Australian super system? Now, we always get asked this question. I know from when I was an advisor a million years ago, there were some ways. I know enough to be dangerous that it's a different world now. And I'll hand it to you, James Ridley. Yeah.
Sure. So there are ways, but it is a very clunky way to bring it home. It's unfortunately a process which is riddled with friction. The minimum criteria is you need to be 55. So if you're not 55, you can't bring it back to Australia. You can't roll it into a self-managed super fund or a retail super fund. So in the meantime, keep an eye on it, see how it's tracking, but that's all you can do. If you're over 55, you can transfer it into what's called a registered QROPS, which is just in the eyes of the HMRC, so the UK's ATO, I guess. If you've got a super fund or a self-managed super fund, which you've registered on that qualified and recognised overseas pension scheme list, you can actually transfer the UK pension across. However, you need to abide by our contribution caps. And that means you can only transfer a maximum in the current financial year right now, $330,000. Next year, it'll be a bit more than that because we're indexing our caps, but there are restrictions on that. So it's not an easy process. There's still a bit, there's a lot of myths out there that when you come back to Australia, you can just transfer it back into your Australian super fund. You can't. You need to wait until you're 55 and then you need to abide by the relevant rollover provisions. And you usually need a UK advisor to also sign off on the transfer as well. So you need to really use a dedicated specialist or team to do so.
What a pain in the backside. And wasn't it this thing now that it is so laced with like landmines that you really wouldn't want to mesh that money with Australian super, like your own Australian superannuation funds? You'd set up a separate QROP sponsored or, you know, approved account.
No, you are spot on. So the additional reporting requirements, so when you bring across those funds into, say, your super fund, you still have additional reporting requirements for another minimum 5 years, the HMRC, to ensure that you're using those monies correctly for your retirement. It can be laced with penalty taxes if you're not, up to 20% of the balance that you transferred over. So, yeah, Glenn, you're spot on.
Yeah. So get advice, Mackenzie, once you're over 55 years old. Tamara, if you're moving away for, say, 2 to 5 years, is it better to keep the house in Australia, even though the rent covers 60% of the mortgage? Numbers don't make sense to keep it, but don't want to be priced out if I return to Australia. Should you keep your shares in Australia or set up a new brokerage in the UK for your time over there? Thank you. Great timing for this podcast. Look, I will go out on a limb to say 2 to 5 years, probably based on our last discussion a little bit earlier, keep your shares where they are, right?
We're not. I agree.
Yep. So, but what we're saying now is there is no real, so Tamara's question, James, is can you cash flow the quote unquote negative gearing portion of the property? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, that's the way.
Because rent only covers 60% of the mortgage, so there's still a hole. And
yeah,
I guess realistically, I want to just expand with this, with that property. You know, if Tamara moved, you know, if their house was in Queensland, for example, and they moved to New South Wales, they would have to put a tenant in Queensland and fund the 40% hole in the property, right? But also pay rent in New South Wales. Now, all we're doing is saying, well, you've got to fund rent in the UK and plug the hole back home for the property. So are there any things to watch out for with negative gearing if you are receiving, because you're still an Australian tax resident because you know, 2 to 5 years, I think from what we've learned, you'd probably remain an Australian tax resident unless you're, I don't know.
I reckon 2 to 5 years is, I look at some of my clients, 2 to 5 years, that's a good time frame for you to be able to deem yourself a non-resident. I really do. And I mean, Tamara's talking about plugging the gap there where in this situation, you'd have to be sending back obviously an amount each month to just be able to, you know, continue paying the mortgage repayments, any additional expenses. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess my question, I've just kind of reworded it so it makes sense. Yeah. If Tamara is a tax resident of the UK, what's the deal with having a negative geared property in Australia? Is it worth doing it or not? Regardless
Great
of
question.
The, so regardless of the question, oh, we don't want to be priced out of the market, regardless of the 6-year rule, okay, and we can talk about that, but mm-hmm. yeah, is it worth, and we, again, sorry, I'm just talking out loud, we don't do things just for the tax or whatnot, but how does that work?
Yeah, well, I mean, negative gearing is a thing for non-residents. She can accumulate those income losses on her tax return for the next 2 to 5 years and have a very large maybe income loss when she returns. And then when she returns, if she's employed again, she get a very large tax refund because all the income losses would then be offset in that first year. You know,
where would she get the refund from, the UK or Australia?
No, Australia, the ATO.
Yep.
So, and this is assuming come back in year 6, as an example, employed locally, and then the losses just get wiped out.
Mm. So on that, realistically, for I just hate selling properties out of fear. I hate selling properties if it's a great location, there's plenty of upside. So practically for Tamara, you'd likely want to look at moving to an interest-only loan to start with, just to if it's not already, and it probably isn't because it's, I assume they're living in it. Mm. And then would you say, like just kind of doing some projections. It's like, okay, we think we're earning this many pounds in the UK. Look, we need, you know, 40% hole. Like we need to come up with 15, 20 grand a year to plug that hole in Australia. We think it's possible. And then just manage it year on year.
Mm-hmm. The risk that's associated with that is if Tamara is in a position where they can't manage it and they have to sell, whilst they're a non-resident, there's going to be tax implications. So there's a big risk in that. You want to be sure that you can plug the gap in those mortgage repayments. Even if it's interest only, that's naturally going to reduce some of the cash flow commitment each month. But if you're going to be in a position in 18 months' time or 3 years' time when you're a non-resident of Australia and you're selling maybe the old home, you will be smacked with CGT in the event it's gone up, but your tax rates are a lot more severe because you're a non-resident. So you really need to be sure that you're in a comfortable position to be able to maintain the mortgage and hold on to the asset. But, you know, if you're moving to the UK, as an example, living in London, rent is not cheap in London if you're trying to get some of those good areas.
Yeah, far out. So this is a really big question and a really big deal. So I hear you saying, in a perfect world, before you get on that flippin' plane, you got to make sure whether you're committing to holding this property for 5 years or until you return, or flick it now and get the CGT concessions because it's your house.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Like that is crystal clear. And that is probably the hardest decision a lot of expats make. You know, do we sell now or do we wear the cost of the mortgage whilst we're away? We rent it out and try and hold on. And then that other question that she raised in there, you know, or not question, but comment was about, you know, so we don't get priced out. You won't get priced out as long as you're doing something else with, say, the proceeds to keep growing your wealth along the way.
Yeah. So just really mansplaining it back to me, if ordinarily they paid $500,000 for the house, it's now worth $800,000, they sold it tomorrow, that's $300,000 of growth because they're living in it, it's tax-free, giddy up, baby, take that money,
correct.
Right?
Yep,
if
absolutely.
If they're a resident of another country and no longer an Australian tax resident, they paid $500 for it, sold it for $800,000, that $300,000 comes online at a straight 32.5%?
Well, more actually.
Okay.
So there's another, I guess, caveat to that as well, unfortunately, for expats. The $300,000 is going to be a taxable gain that they're going to need to record in their non-resident tax returns. The time that they've lived in that property means they'll get to discount a portion of the actual capital gain, but only for the period that they've lived in it. If they've sold it and they've been overseas for 2 years, those 2 years that they've been overseas, they don't get to apply that 50% CGT discount concession to. And then tax rates for non-residents, you know, it's very punitive. It's 32.5% up to 120,000, then 120 to essentially 200, goes up again to 37%, and then it goes up again to 45%. So if Tamara owns this house herself, then her average tax rate is going to be more than 32.5%. It's going to be a lot more than that.
Yikes. So that's going to be the biggest issue if someone owns their family home and wants to move overseas for a couple of years. Because there's no issue there with shares, really, is there?
No, shares are very different.
Because you don't have debt behind it, so it's easy to hold.
It's not leverage.
Yeah.
The only thing is that deemed disposal event. You know, if you've held that portfolio for a couple of years of shares, as an example, and then you become a non-resident, you usually opt into deemed disposal. So that capital gain that's been growing on that portfolio, you'll need to pay some tax on it, but you're owed all your normal concessions. You know, you've held it for more than 12 months, so you get the 50% discount. You pay some tax on that final tax return, and then going forward, it's all tax-free. It means you can funnel some of your surplus into it, keep growing it.
Mm. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and continue your questions right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, we're back. We're keeping it fast and loose with the housekeeping this week. We're not doing a community segment of the week. I'm just here to say, remember, we've got the Retire Right podcast. If you're over 50, over 55, you know someone who is over 50 or over 55, send them this podcast. Listen to this podcast. We did this for those who are at the second half of their working career. It's Retire Right. It's hosted by a licensed retirement advisor. And then secondly, our podcast, Financially Fierce, hosted by Jessica Brady. It's an awesome show if you want some other money content. I'm not on it. She's awesome. It's her only at the moment. And she talks about stuff and then answers your questions. Really good financial content. So you can check out Retire Right or Financially Fierce for some extra listening options. All right. Colin asks, for those of us with dual citizenship, things to consider for living in two countries partway through the year in retirement. Sounds like a freaking can of worms. Potential pitfalls like 3 to 6 months in separate countries. How best to structure things when you have assets and potential pensions from two different countries.
Yeah, it's a really common one, actually. I think a lot of people love the idea of being able to split their time between two countries in retirement.
Endless summer, baby.
Oh yeah, chase it. So it sounds great, but ultimately you will still probably be a tax resident of Australia the whole time, because it's really hard to just become a non-resident of Australia. You can't just do it 6 months off, 6 months on. So the most common scenario that we see playing out in that situation, dual citizenship, 3 to 6 months a year, is you're still an Australian tax resident. You still have your sort of home base back in Australia. And then you might have maybe a home base in the other country. And it might also mean you might be a tax resident there as well. But we do have double taxation agreements with a lot of countries, over 200 now, which means that it ideally results in you not paying any additional tax. However, the sort of the hard part with those scenarios is the ATO doesn't treat a lot of foreign pensions as foreign pensions, and therefore they're treated often as some sort of investment trust, which means they're going to tax you on the income stream that you're going to pull from that.
Okay, right. So whoa. So you're saying, and this is why we get people like James on, because he knows it. So what you're saying, Centrelink, for example, the ATO, they're just treating, ordinarily if I'm in the, Pensionistan country and you get an age pension there and it's tax-free there, and then you move to Australia, the pension from Pensionistan that comes in, the ATO is just like, yeah, we don't care. We're just treating that as investment income effectively.
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of state-based pensions, and that's kind of what we refer to them as, depending on where you are in Europe or somewhere.
Or there could be like a county pension from the US because you're a fireman or an ambulance gal or something like that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, some of those state-based pensions can be tax-free, but if it's sort of a privatized sort of pension, like a super fund, super fund's not privatized, but unfortunately, the withdrawals are going to be taxable by the ATO. They will have a portion of them within that account, which will be tax exempt. So it does require a bit of finesse from the accountant to identify that. But when we look at a lot of sort of those types of pensions, annuities, which come from a lot of foreign countries, there's what's called a undeducted purchase price. That's a deduction that you can apply for in your Australian tax return to offset a portion of the income. And again, it's something that we need to submit to the ATO as almost like an application. So they can review the pension that you're receiving and go, okay, we understand that Glenn's receiving this pension. We're going to allow 35% of that pension to be completely exempt from Australian tax. And then that's the deduction you get in your Australian tax return. So that's an example.
So what you're saying on that dual citizenship thing, mm-hmm. Pick your poison. Like, just pick your PIN, your home address or whatever, your tax residency, if you will, to what country that if you were sick and you had to go to hospital or get elective surgery, you're going to do it in that country. Or, because if you're a dual citizen of, say, Australia and another country that has, healthcare like we have, it's free for you regardless, right?
Yeah. So yeah, that's right.
I think as confusing as this question is, it's unconfusing. It's probably not even a word. You've just got to put your flag on one hill and pick that and make that quote unquote home. And I'd probably say to help you with that, if you were sick or if you had to get some elective surgery and you couldn't fly, or they said, oh, COVID's happening again, you won't be able to fly, you can be like, oh, well, we're home already. It's Australia. We're calling Australia home. Or maybe it's a question, where do you want you to be buried? Call that home. I don't know, but is that a fair bit of waffle, or let's move on? Don't answer that, but you can if you want.
No, well, I want to talk about healthcare, because healthcare, I mean, I like to use the US as a really good example.
A really good example as a really bad example?
Absolutely. Why not?
So bad.
It's terribly expensive over in the US, and we have a lot of Australians that do look to repatriate when they're sort of coming into maybe 4 to 5 more years left in their working, but they want to retire back in Australia because of the cost of healthcare in the US is too expensive. They'd rather have a private health insurance policy and Medicare because it's a lot cheaper. So we do have a lot of people basing themselves out of Australia for that exact reason. And then maybe if they're going to base themselves 3 to 6 months in another country, they'll just have a travel insurance policy, which is going to cover them off. But if they're getting sick, they'll fly back to Australia.
Okay. On this health thing, Ryan asked, I'm seeking some advice for health insurance. I spend half my year in Australia and the other in France with my wife. Is there an insurance policy which covers health, so ambulance and basic hospital and travel, repatriation and emergency health? At the moment, I'm paying the Medicare level surcharge and paying travel insurance, just trying to find a more economical option. Sounds like another freaking can of worms.
It certainly is. There's not really too many expat health insurance policies. I know we used to not do some internally, but we'd just pass on to NIB, but they don't do them anymore.
Newcastle Industrial Benefits, their head office is like 2 seconds from my house.
There are some expat health insurance policies, but they're ridiculously expensive. The ones that we saw in the past were over $12,000 for an individual, and it's not very economical if that's what obviously we're talking about. So they don't really exist. You're going to have maybe your health insurance in your home country, your base, and then you'll have some travel insurance, and then that's very common.
Okay, question. Mm-hmm. $12,000 a year, right? That's a lot of money. For an Aussie or anyone, okay. But if you frame it in the way, like there are some American households who are paying that for health insurance, okay, which is crazy. But yeah. If you're like overseas and you're earning really good money, or you might be in a tax-free country, or you're in a country where you're earning 150, 200 grand and your tax rate's 20% or something crazy, write the freaking check and get your health insurance. But as you said, it's probably for 12 grand for one person. But all that to say, it's expensive, yes, but look at the other factors. Are you printing money in the UAE earning 500 grand a year and not paying income tax? I've met people like you before. Trust me, it's a thing. I'm thinking about moving This Is Money to the UAE and producing it from there. Yeah. Why not make some money for a few years? Nah, wouldn't do that. Can't be bothered. Okay. Anything else on the health insurance thing, or are you done with me?
Oh, no, the last one is like if you are in a few different countries, like there are local private health insurance policies you can get. So, you know, you're not sort of carved out from that. You can get them. If you're wanting an expat policy which covers multiple countries, they're just expensive. I think they're expensive. If you're in a tax-free country, maybe not so much.
Now, if you do have a suite of life and income insurances in Australia and they're paid from your super or your income insurance in your own name and you don't have any type of territorial exclusions and all that and you're going overseas for 2 to 5 years, please, for the love of God, just keep paying them or do what you want. Anna Lee... Who gave this guy a podcast? to speak with your advisor, but I'm right. I'd love to go and live in Europe with my young son for a while, but I'm unsure of the financial implications from Centrelink and if there is support over there from a European type Centrelink place. I want to work there too, but I don't know where to start financially. So basically, can I still get Centrelink benefits if I'm living abroad? Isn't there like some 6 month or 3 month rule or something with Centrelink? If you're not here, you're not getting our money.
Yeah, you're pretty right there. It's usually if you're not, Centrelink generally has an Australian resident requirement. Right. So the age pension you can get technically overseas, but it's dialed back. It's not the full age pension, even if you qualify based on the assets test. Mm. And then for general sort of new start allowances, those sort of things, yeah, you're going to be pretty hard-pressed trying to continue that if you move overseas because of the residency requirements.
Hey, randomly, have we booked you in for an episode with Martin on Retirerite?
No.
We should do one.
Yeah, I'm keen.
Yeah, all right, sweet. Because it'd be cool for like people who want to retire and live in Thailand and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll flag that, everyone. There you go. Look out for that. Retirerite. James Ridley. Yep. Ridley, believe it or not. Yeah. Do people annoy you with that all the time?
Not too much, actually. I have heard it. I've heard it a few.
James is like the most polite, considerate person, and I'm a buffoon. Rebecca, does the UK student loan debt affect borrowing power for home loans in Australia? Or are you better off using savings for a deposit to pay off UK student debt? Oh, that's an interesting one. I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so as well. I mean, I'm not going to be able to call a mortgage broker.
Let's call a mortgage broker.
You need to. That's like, I'm not a mortgage broker, but that's a really good question.
Last episode, I called Rachel Croon's work phone, got the office. I'm calling her personal phone now, guys. So
that's a good question.
Let's put this on. People hate when I ambush them. She's probably doing like the school run or something.
Hey, how you going?
Hey, good. Rach, before you say anything, you're being recorded for a podcast and like I did with Joe the other week.
Cool. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You can't hear him, but I'm doing an episode with James Ridley. He's a expat financial advisor, right? All that to say, we're answering listener questions. And I should first say, is now a good time to talk? If not, I can call you back.
Yeah, sure. I've just pulled over.
Yeah, sweet. Awesome. Okay, so there's a question here. Does UK student loan debt affect borrowing power for Australian home loans? So I think the question is, if someone had a student loan debt overseas and they want to loan in Australia, do any banks or lenders here ask about foreign debt?
Well, they do ask about foreign debt in general, but if it came to a student loan, I would say it wouldn't affect borrowing here because the UK loans are on, you pay those back on your earning in the UK.
Right.
So I'm guessing you wouldn't be making repayments on that student debt.
Mm, yeah, okay.
Is that the case?
Well, we don't know. We don't know enough information, but do you know much about student debt in the UK, James?
No,
he doesn't either. Look,
I've seen it before where they don't need to disclose it because no repayments are being made.
Right.
Because they're not earning money in the UK.
Sure. But the weird thing is, like, if you're in the UK and you've got HECS debt in Australia, HECS still want their payments. So it's, a wild time.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, I have not come across up against it where they've had to disclose it.
Yeah, no, that's fine. All right, Rach, thank you so much. And a shout-out, everyone, Rach Croon from Sphere Home Loans. They are supporting our live event in Townsville, and that episode is going up next week, so you will hear that. And, yeah, thanks for supporting that live event, Rach.
No worries. Hope Townsville's great.
It will be humid. All right, Rach, thank you so much. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's funny, though, where when we are applying for a mortgage in Australia, they look at HECS debt, but obviously foreign student debt doesn't get picked up at all. I wouldn't imagine there's any way for the loan providers to sort of scour the world for your student debts would be recorded.
So there you go, Rebecca. I would, like anything, you answer questions truthfully. But if some questions aren't asked, in some instances, you don't voluntarily make things confusing. Okay, there's a question here from Natasha. If planning to move to New Zealand or another country, but you have shares invested in Australia, what are the options? Same with, life insurance, health insurance. I need to redeclare everything, or can it be sent to the insurance company as a handover type thing? And there was another question there, while living overseas, should I be topping up my super? I'm in Sweden. I think from these questions, we've kind of answered, it all comes back to your intentions, isn't it? If you are moving overseas, how long are you over there for and what's your intention to return?
That's right.
That's the best starting point, isn't it?
Yep.
But in terms of this one here from Sweden, should I be topping up super when I'm also building a pension in this country I live in? I think when it comes to money, more is more. If you're not spending all your money, it needs to be invested for the future. If your future is going to be in Australia, it might be a thing, instead of setting up a new investment account in Australia, you've already got one set up and it's called superannuation. Do you have any comments about that?
Again, intentions. They are going to come back and retire in Australia. I still think superannuation is just one of the most tax efficient ways you can accrue wealth, just because of the internal tax rates and then tax free when you're in pension mode. So if there is extra surplus, it is worthwhile. Non-concessional contributions are the most common for expats, just because they are likely not trying to offset other income back in Australia. And super is agnostic regardless of you being a resident or non-resident. So you absolutely can contribute to super whilst you're overseas. You need to be mindful if you are in the US, because the US has their own set of rules around Australian super, and that's probably going to be, that can be an episode in itself, to be honest.
Yeah.
I agree with building your super. I also agree if you're young and you've got other goals like property, then that might not make sense. You might be working towards a deposit, so you think of another means to keep growing wealth but not walking away in super.
But that's the whole thing. Like, if you're intentional with your money, do what you want to do based on the cards that you've dealt at the time. When I started my own business, I did the priority of I'm building my own business. I was a sole trader, or then, you know, I was an employee earning minimum wage, quote unquote, which was paying some super. But the lion's share of my wealth, I was saving for a home deposit at the expense of super because I wanted a home. So, you know, as a sole trader, by law, you don't have to put money in super. But you've got the choice. I need to plan for my future. Yes, it's good for my future to own a home as soon as possible, so I might do that. But knowingly, I've got to then maybe catch up on my super. So I look at these questions like this. 101, we're living on less than we earn wherever we are in the world. Simple facts. Now, if there's a period of time when you're living and renting in London and you don't have 2 cents to scratch together after you've paid rent and some food and the odd little trip away over that 3-year period, I'm not stressing too much. But is it going to be that suspended animation for 20 years when you're not doing anything for yourself? That's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Something needs to change then.
Yeah, and Rachel had a question like an Australian working in Japan, investing into super versus shares, which kind of, you know, we've covered. But the question I want to answer here, how do I know if I'm a tax resident of Australia or not? Is that simply you doing an Australian tax return?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I'd say Rachel might have been overseas for not too long if she's asking that kind of question. I mean, first and foremost, if you are going to, again, be based overseas for a couple of years, you need to understand whether it is best to keep yourself an Australian tax resident, because that's one thing we haven't really talked about. It's a lot easier for you to keep yourself an Australian tax resident, but understand what that means when it comes to your tax return, capturing your overseas wage income, all those sort of things. It might result in you paying extra tax to the ATO. Generally, if you're not coming back for 3, 5, 7, 10 years, which is very common, you are likely going to be a non-resident of Australia. But also arm yourself with the information to know what that means on your assets back in Australia. What's the tax change? You know, are you going to be up for tax on your shares that you've held for a while? What's it mean for your property, your rental property? Plan around that. Is property or owning property still the right investment strategy? We ran that scenario case study earlier on today's episode. It's a tough one. It's definitely depend on your situation. If you want to know, best way is probably just actually having maybe a bit of a discovery consult with us to identify whether you are tax resident or not. It's really hard depending on, without knowing more of what's going on in Rachel's life.
Yeah. And this is like another question that's very similar. Ava, I have the opportunity to move to a tax-free country like UAE and save a bit of money. And then it goes back to, I have the property ties in Australia. How can I make myself a non-tax resident in Australia while I'm overseas? So just on that, and then she says, do I have to sell my properties / rent them out? Obviously, if you're moving somewhere that has a tax rate of zero, you'd want to become a tax resident there the minute you land.
Yeah.
Effectively.
As soon as you can, for sure.
Yeah. So in this situation, it's probably really hard, right? Like, without knowing the numbers, because I've legitimately had clients earning, you know, half a ton, we'll call that $500,000 in the UAE, tax-free. Yeah, I'll keep my properties in Australia, and if there's a mortgage against them, I'll top them up. Like,
yeah,
life's absolutely pretty good, right?
Yeah.
So I think it is that thing, as soon as you land, how does she cut ties with Australia and almost like, we're just changing Medicare address, every address that we can think of from day one to UAE.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's a really good starting point. You know, look at what you've got going back on, even from a financial institution. So look at your banks that you've got back in Australia. Make sure they're updated to show the fact that you're now a resident in the UAE. You'll have a new home address. You'll have an apartment or a villa. You're updating Medicare, logging onto your MyGov, removing probably the MyGov two-factor authentication, because you're not going to be keeping your Australian mobile number anymore.
No, if you're not a resident. Local. Yeah.
That's right. removing all your subscriptions that you have back in Australia because you won't be using them, updating those kind of details. That's really important. You won't hold private health insurance back in Australia. You'll put that on hold for as long as you can because you're no longer a resident here, so you can't use it in Australia. What's the point?
If you – your driver's license, might you go and pay for a 10-year one and put it in the drawer and move on with your life? Because then
it's a good question. It's a good question.
Yeah. If you moved over and you had a year to go on your driver's license – and then it lapsed, well, why are you renewing it if you're not a resident here? But if I happen to have a 10-year one...
Well, that's right. Those are little things you can do before you declare yourself as a non-resident, absolutely. But ideally, if you're in the UAE, you're living in Dubai or Abu Dhabi, you've got a local license over there. You know, you've got an international driving permit, so there's not a need to keep your New South Wales or Queensland driver's license valid. Mm. When you come back to Australia and you're moving here permanently, that's when you'll reactivate it. But those are things.
And just in your experience with the reactivation, would they then go the UAE license that you got based on the Australian license? You can convert that back pretty easily?
Pretty easily, yes.
I guess it's state-based, so it's hard for you to give an exact response, yeah.
An example would be a client of mine who's recently retired, came back from the US. They've never held an Australian driver's license ever, but they hold a US license. So unfortunately, they're having to sit through some tests because they've never been tested here. So when there's been no previous record of you owning a state license here in Australia, you will have to be tested. That's normal.
I mean, the tests, sure, I get that, but I don't want to get my L's again and have to do hours.
No. You can bypass some of those and get some exemptions around that.
Yep.
But it's mainly a case where if you already hold a license, it expires, you go over to the UAE, you get a driving permit over there, you're over there for 7 or 8 years making some bang, and then you come back, you'll be able to reactivate the Australian one.
Yeah. And that's it. Like, if you want to move to the UAE and basically pay no income tax from day one, you've got to have a digital track footprint or digital footprint where you've changed as much as possible that you have no connection to Australia.
Yeah, and that's right.
You know, make sure you don't have a short sore shoulder from rolling in all your cash. But you know, if you're not paying any income tax, you probably can afford to pay for some private health insurance. You can probably can afford to top up your investment properties. You probably can afford, actually this is probably a curly one, to slip some money into super.
You can. You can still contribute to super. That's actually a really common question we get. If I contribute to my super, is that going to have an impact on my tax residency? There hasn't been a tax ruling case.
Super's its own entity. It's not an individual entity.
That's right. And it is 100% agnostic. The only rules with super would be if we're talking about self-managed super funds and if you're a non-resident.
Yeah, so we'll touch on that. So if you've got a self-managed super fund and you leave Australia, the self-managed super fund's got to wind up effectively?
It can wind up, or there is a concept called rubber stamping where you're going to nominate new directors of, say, the corporate trustee that are still Australian tax residents. That's a short-term solution. It's not a permanent solution. That might solve the whole issue for a couple of years, but then you're still probably going to have to look at winding it back to a normal retail super fund. They are looking at changing the ability to contribute to super whilst you're a non-resident, which is a really good outcome. That's something that came from the budget last year. Haven't seen that legislated just yet. That's exciting. But one thing that often happens is we see a lot of people sort of accidentally break the active members test where they contribute to their SMSF, but they've been a non-resident for 7 years or something ridiculous. Mm. And it's like, uh-oh, you might be on the ATO's radar now to wind that up ASAP and get taxed by up to 45%.
Yeah, far out. And then just finally, if someone leaves Australia and they're 30 and they want to move to the UK or US for good, they can't touch their super until a condition of release in Australia.
Exactly right. Nothing changes there. We've actually got probably the strictest rules when it comes to accessing our retirement funds. So no, you wouldn't be able to withdraw them, pull them out or anything like that. It's another common question we get. They're still landlocked here until 60 or another type of condition of release, such as a permanent capacity or financial hardship.
Yeah. And finishing, Laura said, like, you know, when repatriating back to Australia, you know, what do we have to do? You know, we've got to obviously sort our health insurance again, notify the ATO, ? So just on that, if someone repatriated back to Australia and they're in their 40s, they would be paying the lifetime health cover loading.
Good. It's a really good point you make. They shouldn't if they can provide.
That they were insured overseas or something, or?
There's two things. So if they can provide to the their private health insurance provider their passport travel history, they won't have to provide or pay the lifetime health cover loading.
That's
the main one. Yep. It's something you actually have to request. But that should, I suppose, get you out of having to pay the lifetime health cover loading. Generally speaking, if we're living overseas, we have up to just over 1,000 days in which we can be back in Australia for that entire period without the lifetime health cover loading. So that's sort of the main part there. 1,000 days is a lot of time, you know, when you think about it. It's a couple of years worth, to be honest. So if you're overseas for 10 years, you might only be back in Australia over that 10-year period, maximum maybe 6 months for just general holidays, catching up with friends and family. So it's very unlikely the lifetime health cover loading should actually apply to you. If it does, something has gone wrong when you've actually re-kickstarted that policy. I still pick up some of our expat clients that have just been onboarded with lifetime health cover loadings of up to 50%. And I'm just like, wow, you're paying an extra couple of $1,000 here, because when you set it up, do you notify them that you're overseas for a period? Did you give me your passport history? All these things. And they're like, no, we didn't even know that was a thing. So they just accepted it. So I reckon there's a lot of Australians copying it.
So to Laura's comment about, you know, repatriating, notifying ATO, is it true that, you know, if she got a job here, provide the tax file number to the employer, they would just start withholding, you'd pretty much put a button on that the first financial year and get your accountant to be like, yep, we're just making it clear that we're now claiming a return here as a tax resident?
Yeah, absolutely. The other things you should look at doing is if you've, you know, updating your financial banks, your banks, all those sort of things, that you're back in Australia, normal Aussie resident, that way they're not withholding any tax on your interest income. It's the same with any investment accounts or share accounts. You know, with private health insurance, you should look to reactivate that within 12 months of your arriving. That's sort of your flexible time frame.
Yep.
After 12 months, they will give you lifetime health covering loading regardless. So
yeah,
cool. 12 months, you need to be active with that one. But updating all those sort of platforms and portals, getting on the ATO MyGov, letting them know your new home address, same with Medicare, getting your Medicare card if you haven't renewed it, all those sort of fun things that you'll have to do once more.
Yeah. Well, on your website, do you have checklists about departure, pre-departure, repatriation that people can log in and have a look at?
We do. We do. We've got a pre-departure checklist, and we've also got a repatriation checklist. So these are just general things to get you thinking, especially about the right sort of categories when it comes to financial tax, those sort of implications. And they're usually just 1 to 3 pages, sort of tick boxes to make sure that you're thinking about the right things when you come home, but also making sure you're winding up things correctly in your foreign country. That's one thing we see. You forget to do that final tax return when you leave Singapore, and then the Singapore IRD is chasing you for that final tax, so they can often, you know, hit you up with a few penalties as well. So it's just those sort of things you still need to be mindful of when you come back to Australia. You need to make sure you tie off things in the other country first.
If you and your bride were going to be going overseas and you could pick a country to be a digital nomad or live and work from, based on the rules and all your experience, where would you be heading?
Oh, I know.
Are you married yet?
Engaged. I'm still engaged. We're getting married later this year in August. So, Italy. Don't really need to think about that one.
And that's just because we like it, or because the Italian government's easy to work with?
Well, Camille, she can get citizenship. So we can get citizenship there if we wanted to. Yep. However, Italy's just introduced a bit of a digital nomad visa, which is coming into effect. And it gives you a bit more flexibility to get residency there. Personally, we love Italy. We love the food. We love the countryside. We love Tuscany. You know, we can't really whinge about it at all.
Do you know much about digital nomad visas for Spain?
Ooh, not too much, sorry.
Okay. Friend of mine moving there. I'm like, get an extra room in your house and I'll visit, but I probably wouldn't be there more than 3 months anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
They've become common over in Indonesia, especially Bali, where they're pretty favorable from a tax aspect. But it's the same with the UAE. You mentioned it earlier where a lot of Australians, they are offshoring their businesses over to the UAE because you can actually set up a business there, you can restructure, and then that way a lot of your income, your expenses are coming through there, and you might come back to Australia every now and then, but you are basing yourself out of there. But that's another way that you can actually get a residency visa over there by setting up a business. So
maybe old Glennie James needs to move to the UAE. Is that what we're saying?
Maybe. I mean, just make sure when you move there, you live in an apartment rather out in the villas where they all get flooded.
No worries. Well, James Ridley from Atlas Wealth, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast. We'll put a link in the show notes to the website. We really appreciate you answering all our questions and putting up with me.
No worries, Glenn. Thanks for having me on again. It's really great.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. If you are interested in furthering your education around money, your career or property, we have three books that might help. Check out Sort Your Money Out, Sort Your Career Out and Sort Your Property Out. Find these wherever good books are sold or via the link in the podcast show notes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.